The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'd like to continue a conversation about the Four Noble Truths. First, I'll just talk about the Four Noble Truths a little bit, just to set a context. When the Buddha began exploring, he had kind of a quest, you might say, of what is wrong with this world. I mean, he looked out at the world and saw that there's just a lot of struggle, a lot of suffering, and he wanted to understand that. What is this struggle? What is the suffering? Why do people struggle and suffer so much? And so this was his exploration. And the Four Noble Truths, it's not surprisingly, are framed around this question of struggle and suffering. The Pali term dukkha, which I've been talking about for the last few weeks, is usually translated as suffering, but it's a very broad term. It doesn't mean just the kind of major suffering that we sometimes think, the word suffering means to us. Suffering often has this connotation of being a pretty big thing. But the word in Pali has a much subtler connotation. It can mean the subtlest kinds of unease or dissatisfaction. It's like, this is just isn't quite right. Things just aren't quite right. That's a form of dukkha. It ranges from there all the way up through loss of a partner, of a parent, being in having a diagnosis of cancer, all the kind of major things that we struggle with and suffer with in our lives. So this dukkha that the Buddha went out exploring about, this question of struggle, of suffering, what he discovered in his own exploration is that while there's stuff happening in the world, stuff happening to us, things happening to us, things happening around us, we normally impute our suffering into the things that are happening. We would impute our suffering into the diagnosis of cancer or into the death of a partner. And what the Buddha realized or recognized is that while there is some, that aspect of struggle exists in the world and is going to exist. In transcending suffering, the Buddha didn't transcend aging, illness, and death in this life. He continued to grow old, and he had a bad back, and he died of, poisoned pork. those things are just the reality of life. But what he discovered is that there's a way to orient our minds towards our experience where we're not struggling so much with the conditions of life. Instead, we are able to be balanced at ease with things as they are, balanced with all the conditions as they come and go. The mind can be equanimous, balanced. So, now that might sound a little strange to be balanced around the death of a partner. And yet, this is an interesting thought or exploration for us. What would it mean to be balanced? Not that we wouldn't feel the loss. In fact, there's a story of the Buddha when his two main disciples died. He said, wow, this assembly seems empty without these, my two main disciples. And so he was expressing a sense of loss, of the sense that there's a change here. And there's a feeling of emptiness without these two people. And yet he wasn't incapacitated in any way, or he didn't have that sense of, my understanding is he didn't have that sense of being distraught about it. So there's this quality of heart which is not fighting the world, that when it meets struggle, suffering, when it meets suffering, when it meets distress in the world, when it meets pain, when it meets loss, that that heart that's open and not contracted will respond with compassion. And so this is the quality that the Buddha discovered in terms of what it means to meet suffering. Does it mean to meet pain in our lives without resistance? And it opens us to compassion. The heart is not contracted or tight around it. And so he discovered, actually, the vast majority of what we call suffering in our lives is actually the contracted heart, the heart that is tight around what is actually happening. And he found a way towards releasing that heart, releasing it so that we can flow with experience instead of fighting, struggling with experience. So in his statement of the Four Noble Truths, the first thing he said is, there's suffering. He didn't say everything is suffering. He said, you are going to meet suffering in your life. There is suffering. And then he said, this suffering, this dukkha, let's keep in mind this is about the range of struggle from dissatisfaction to strong struggle and suffering. He said, this dukkha has a cause. It's not random in our lives. It actually has a cause. And that cause is actually internal. It's within our own mind and body. It has to do with this contraction, essentially, this holding, this tightening, this resistance to things as they are. The word he put to it is craving. Basically, that we crave things to be other than they are. And this is the source of our struggles, of our suffering. And then he said, and it's possible, because suffering has a cause, if he thought to himself, if it were possible to let go of that cause, then the suffering that results from that cause would vanish, would go away. And he found that possibility for himself. So this is the third noble truth. The first noble truth, there is suffering. Second noble truth, the suffering has a cause, this craving. The third noble truth is that it's possible to find the end of that suffering, that if we release the craving, that suffering will come to an end. This endless feeling of being at war with the world, with our experience, in small wars and large wars. So it's possible, he said, it's possible for this suffering to come to an end. And then he laid out for us a path, a set of practices that will lead us, if we choose to engage with them, to find for ourselves, to understand for ourselves this ending of suffering. So these Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the ending of suffering, the truth of the path leading to the ending of suffering. Now these are not truths that are, kind of set out there and the Buddha said, believe these. What he said rather was engage with these. He said, these are truths that are meant to be practiced with, engaged with. And he actually offered us some tools, some practices to explore with each of these truths. He said that we should understand suffering. We should get to know it in our minds. How does it happen in our minds? We should let go of the cause of suffering. We should realize the ending of suffering, and we should cultivate the path. And so he was really, really practical in his approach to a spiritual path, a spiritual practice. He didn't ask us to believe things, per se. He said, engage. You know, find out the truth, discover the truth of this for yourself by engaging. Cultivate the practices. Understand suffering. You know, cultivating the practice is actually where we have to start, right? The fourth noble truth. We really have to start there. Cultivate the practices. Those practices that the Buddha offers helps us to understand suffering, helps us to get to know it. That very understanding, as we understand suffering ourselves, directly meet it, turn our with mindfulness towards the experience that we consider to be suffering, we begin to understand how it happens in our minds. We see that our minds are contributing to it. And we begin to understand how it might be possible to let go of that, of those ways that we contribute to our suffering. And then we directly begin to experience for ourselves, in small moments perhaps at first, releases from the suffering. And we begin to see for ourselves the possibility of freedom, the possibility of that balance of mind, that uncontracted heart, that open heart that can meet joy and sorrow without feeling like it's just being buffeted around. This heart that can meet with love, with compassion, with joy, all of the conditions of the world. So for the past few weeks, I'd been talking about the first noble truth, and tonight I'd like to explore and begin to explore the second noble truth, to talk a little bit about this cause of suffering. So the first thing I want to just start with, to just kind of highlight, is that the second noble truth says there is a cause of suffering. It's not random in our lives. You know, we sometimes think that it is. We wander through our day and we, you know, drive down the freeway and somebody cuts us off and it's like, well, why did they do that? And, you know, that seems kind of random to us. And yet our reaction to that, our response to that, isn't so random. It's conditioned based on many of the ways that we've been engaging with the world for our whole lives. So the cause that the Buddha pointed to, the fact that suffering has a cause, it's not a random event in our lives. And because of this, as I said a little while ago, the Buddha pointed to the fact that it has a cause means that it's possible to free ourselves from the cause. If we can find a way to let go of that cause, there's a possibility for freedom. So the cause of suffering, as the Buddha stated it, is craving. The Pali term, tanha, is usually translated as craving, but I'm going to explore some different translations of the word. The first thing to explore is the literal meaning of the word, I understand, is thirst. So it's got a kind of a, you know, almost a biological neediness to it. You know how when you're thirsty, if you're really thirsty, you know, if you've been, you know, walking in the hot sun for a long time without water, you know, your body just craves that water. So this is the kind of quality in the mind that is pointed to by this craving. It's got a neediness to it. An almost biological sense of, I have to have this. There's a stickiness around wanting, desire, that causes suffering. So desire, wanting, craving, these are various translations for this term of wanting. And the Buddha says this is the cause of suffering. I want to just pause here for a second too, because this often, when I bring up the words desire and wanting, this can be a little bit odd for us, you know, to think about. You know, it's like, well, does all desire cause suffering? You know, do we have to let go of every desire? Not all desire is unskillful. So again, you know, to highlight the stickiness of the kind of wanting that gets us into trouble. It's the kind of wanting that has to have a specific result. So I'll offer you another word for a wholesome kind of desire, a skillful kind of desire, and that might be aspiration. That word doesn't seem to have as much of that quality of stickiness. It's heading us in a direction, it's pointing us in a direction, but perhaps without the demand that things happen on a timetable or with a particular result. It's more of a movement in a direction. Now, we wouldn't engage in a spiritual practice without some form of desire. And so there needs to actually be some kind of motivation to get us engaged with this practice, to get us engaged with exploring. What does it mean to understand suffering? If we didn't want to understand suffering, we'd never begin. So just that's just one thing to know, that there's different kinds of desire. And also another thing to kind of be aware of or cognizant of is that, you know, there's some sense in a way that I think of the practice of transcending suffering. It's kind of being a step-by-step thing. You know, it's like for a little while we engage with certain kinds of wanting. Well, I want to practice meditation and, you know, settle my mind down. And this begins to help us. You know, we settle our mind down in meditation and, you know, it feels good. And that helps us to start to let go of some of the stickier ways we're engaged with the world. Some of the stickier ways that we, you know, think everything's got to change to suit my needs. And so we settle in meditation and we get a sense of what it might mean to be a little more at ease without, you know, having everything in the world be exactly the way we want it to be. And then, because we've then gotten a taste of something a little bit easeful in our meditation, we start to, you know, look for those states of mind in our meditation. We start to sit down in order to get concentrated, sit down in order to feel good with our meditation. And then we start to see that wanting of those states in meditation actually is getting in our way. And then we need to work with that wanting. So, you know, it's like we start by having wanting for meditation, which helps us to let go of some other kinds of wanting, to let go of some of the kinds of wanting around, you know, when I first started meditating, I was in a lot of pain around a loss of a relationship. And, you know, it was a great relief to sit down in meditation and just be isolated for a time from that pain. It allowed me to be there, to let go of the wanting. You know, my boyfriend broken up with me. It's like I both wanted him back and I hated him at the same time. And, you know, a lot of struggle, a lot of suffering around that. And so the meditation really allowed me a respite from it. Allowed me to see the possibility that I didn't have to always be so miserable around it. And so it helped me to begin to let go of some of those ways that I was clinging and craving, you know, wanting him to be, you know, both wanting him to be back in my life and wanting him to be in pain, you know, both sides of it. So the meditation began to give me a sense of how to let go of that kind of wanting. And then as I practiced over the years, I began to see myself wanting the meditation. And then there needs to become a kind of a movement towards not stopping the meditation, but seeing how the very wanting of specific things gets in our way. So there's kind of this staged path, this staged way that we use certain kinds of wanting to help us to overcome and let go of more obvious kinds of suffering. And I'll talk about that more, so it's not the last you'll hear of that. So this craving, this sense of, I mean, craving, the term craving often we think of as meaning, you know, wanting something, wanting to have something. And yet this craving in this sense of the second noble truth both means wanting to have something and wanting to get rid of something. So it's got both sides to it. That both sides that I mentioned with my, you know, my ex-partner, that wanting him back and also wanting him, you know, that aversion, that hatred, that hostility towards him, that wanting him to be suffering. So it includes both sides, this wanting to have something and wanting to get rid of something. And the words for that, greed, aversion. Greed and aversion. So essentially, wanting things to be the way we want them to be. That's this cause of suffering. So why? How does this work? How does this cause suffering for us? So when we want things to be the way we want them to be, if we don't get what we want, if things don't come to be the way we want them to be, well, then the suffering's obvious right away. You know, we get angry, we get irritated, we get frustrated, we get annoyed, we get upset, we get anxious. Things aren't the way we want them to be. There's the suffering right there. Those experiences of anger, frustration, irritation, annoyance, anxiety, those are suffering. So when we want something to be the way we want it and we don't get it, it doesn't happen the way we'd like it, we suffer. If we succeed, if we get the thing that we want, how do we suffer then? You know, and that's not so obvious sometimes, how we're suffering then. So in this case, I pointed to this in the last few weeks around the suffering due to change. That when we get something that we want, there's the inevitability that things will change. And so while in the moment of getting something that we want, it may not be suffering in that moment, the inevitability of change is somewhere in the back of our mind. The fact that this is going to go away somehow, or perhaps be taken from us, kind of weighs on us in subtle ways. So we may experience some sense of fear of loss, a feeling of needing to protect or defend ourselves, our property, just the sense of kind of putting up these barriers and boundaries. And these too are forms of suffering. So we have what we want. We may be happy for a while. And then there's loss. And we suffer in the loss as well. So part of what the Buddha points to here is that, you know, we're kind of trapped by our own wanting. Because what seems to happen for us is that when we have this pattern of wanting and getting something, you know, this is like ingrained in us as human beings. You know, it's not something that we have to try very hard to learn. It comes like within the first minutes of being born. You know, We're hungry, we scream, we get our food. Oh, this is good, I feel good. You know, it's like we learn over and over again when we get what we want, we feel better. You know, it's not a surprise that we want to have things the way we want them to be, because that's how we found happiness for most of our lives. So it's not a surprise. And what seems to happen to us is that because we have this conditioned experience, over and over again we have found, when we get what we want, it feels good, I'm happy. Over and over again, we've had that pattern unfold. It's like, oh, there it is. I'm happy again. I got what I want. We begin to believe that that is the way to happiness. That's it. That's how we become happy. We get what we want. So it doesn't even occur to us there might be another way. You know, we are so stuck on this wheel of getting what we want to find happiness. You know, it even comes about that when we, you know, we get what we want, we have some happiness, and, you know, we know that it's not permanent in a way. We know that it doesn't last. And so immediately we are in the process of finding the next thing to want so that we can get that next moment of happiness. So we're kind of stuck on this wheel that because we've had this sense of happiness that comes from getting what we want, and the only way we know to find happiness is to get what we want, we begin to want things. We want to want. Because wanting to want will give us the satisfaction of wanting being satisfied. So we end up on this kind of wheel. You know, it reinforces the fact that getting what we want brings happiness, and so we look for things to want. Have you ever noticed this sitting in front of the internet, you know, trying to think of something to put into the Google box to search for so that you'll get, ooh, I found something. I found a little piece of information. You know, this is in a very obvious way for us how this cycle of wanting works. We will sit there trying to think of something to want to know. So we are in this cycle, and in the cycle reinforces itself because we get a kind of a double hit of pleasantness when we get what we want. Because when we look at what's going on, when we start to actually pay attention to wanting itself, we see that wanting itself feels off as soon as wanting springs up. As soon as there is wanting, there's a feeling that something is off. There's a feeling of dissatisfaction as soon as there is wanting. So the wanting itself has an unpleasant feeling, an unpleasant quality to it. And the way that we know to get rid of that unpleasant feeling is to get what we want. And so when we get what we want, we have this double hit of having the pleasantness of having the thing that we want and the pleasantness of getting rid of the wanting for a split second. That the feeling of the wanting going away is a big part of how this whole cycle is driven. And that having what we want for a moment gives us a little release, a little bit of relief from that feeling of wanting. And this was the brilliance, actually, of what the Buddha pointed to. He said, you know, if you just allow wanting to end all by itself without following through on the delusion of wanting, essentially, is that it has to be satisfied. But if you instead allow the wanting to come to an end, because it will, it's an impermanent phenomenon also. Impermanence works in our favor here. If you allow that wanting to come to an end, you will see in the moment of the release of that wanting, the pleasantness of that wanting going away, that doesn't come about because that wanting has been grabbed after and acted on. It releases on its own. This was the brilliance of the Buddha, actually, to point out if we allow the wanting to release, we are not conditioning this cycle of wanting and having and getting, which then conditions further wanting, because the only way we know how to satisfy our desires is to have what we want. And the Buddha said, why don't you try this? Let go of the wanting. See if you cannot act on the wanting. And watch the wanting disappear. One of the early times I really saw this clearly, I told this story quite a bit, so some of you may have heard this story. I was doing walking meditation, and there was this tremendous... I was doing walking meditation on a retreat. It was a three-month retreat, and I was being a really good retreatant. I had blinders on. I was not looking at people. We'd been instructed to not look around. It will help you, they said, to not look at people. Okay, I'm going to do this. So I had these blinders on. And I was doing walking meditation, and there were always people around when I was doing walking meditation. There was this intense desire to look at people. And, I'm going to be a good retreatant. I'm not going to look at anybody. For a long time, that's the way I dealt with that wanting. Basically, push it away. Don't pay attention to it. Don't go there. Finally, after several weeks of this, it kind of finally occurred to me, oh, this is wanting. I should look at this wanting. So I began to observe the feeling of wanting. And I began to see that as people came into my field of vision, you know, peripheral vision, because I wasn't looking up, I was kind of looking about 6 feet in front of me all the time at the ground. People came into my peripheral vision, and the wanting would appear. There it is. And I could feel it. It was like magnet. It's like this, look. Look. So I was just feeling that pull, that draw to look at that person, but didn't act on it. Instead, I just watched that feeling. Just, wow, that's so amazing how strong that urge is. And then, you know, just watching the wanting come and go. At one point, I saw it popped, it came in just as somebody entered my peripheral vision. And then when they, like, went around a corner or went into the building, poof, that wanting would disappear. It felt like being released from a vice grip. That feeling of having to, you know, being like, it's like this wanting is a slave driver. You know, you will do this thing. And being released from that, it's like being released from that slave driver. It's like being released from a vice grip. And then for a little while, just a second, I'll take it in just a second. And then for a little while, I really got into watching the wanting because it was so cool to watch it disappear. And then I noticed, so it's like, then I was beginning to see, you know, oh, there's the wanting. Oh, there it is. Oh, there it is. There it is. And then kind of looking forward to when they would disappear. Then poof, there it goes. I was hanging out watching that for a while. And then at some point, what I recognized is that I was actually, and this is kind of like one of those staged things I was talking about, one of those kind of things that as we observe, as we get to know our experience, we start to see how we're holding. What I saw was that I was actually holding on to the wanting in order to see it disappear. And in that moment, in seeing that, you know, there was somebody in my field of vision, as soon as I saw, oh my gosh, I'm actually holding on to this wanting. It's just going to disappear when this person goes into a building. And the wanting vanished right there. So the mind had seen that it was actually, you know, holding on to, watching it in order to see something happen. And then after that point, that wanting just stopped coming up around people in my peripheral vision. It just stopped. It didn't happen anymore. It didn't come up anymore. So, question.
I'm just wondering.
No, get the mic. Just a sec.
I'm just wondering if what we're supposed to do is let go of wanting. Is that the same as saying we're all going to not want anything badly and not care about anything, and we'll all be apathetic about everything? Or?
So that's a great question. So the question being, you know, if we're supposed to let go of wanting, does that mean we're not supposed to care? And you know, the instructions really around wanting are to observe the wanting. You know, to get familiar with it, to see. I mean, I said earlier that there's wholesome kinds of wanting, right? There's wholesome ways to engage with the world that will be manifesting through compassion, through sympathetic joy, through love, through kindness, through balance of mind. And so the motivations for us become, rather than that neediness, they become motivations of compassion and joy and kindness. So it doesn't become flat, in fact. As we begin to let go of wanting, what happens is that we let go of the contraction around needing things to be a certain way and can really enter into life with much more of an open heart and able to respond and resonate to the world with love, with kindness, with joy. So it doesn't feel flat. It doesn't feel not caring. In fact, just the opposite. It's hard for us to understand this. It's hard for us to understand what it would mean to not want, because it seems so embedded in the way that we engage in our world. You know, the way that we engage with relationships. There's an awful lot of wanting in there. You know, I'll love you if you'll love me, or, you know, that kind of reciprocity. And so the exploration really is, the way I look at it, is that there's going to be mixed motivations in our hearts. There's going to be aspects of our caring for somebody that is just pure kindness and love, and aspects of it that have some conditions on it. Like, it's not okay for you to do that. It's not okay for you to say that thing. So there's aspects of it that have conditions on it. And what we're asked to do is to observe our experience and see, where is the stickiness? Where is it that we're caught? Where is it that we're making demands and saying it's not okay? And what aspects of it are this open heart that isn't tight, isn't contracted? So to begin to observe your experience and see, there's going to be both there. Both sides will be present much of the time. And so to begin to tease apart for ourselves which aspects, what parts of our experience are these more beautiful qualities and which parts are these sticky, needy kinds of things. I think you'll find, if you look, actually, there's an awful lot of the way we engage in the world that has this neediness. There's a lot of the ways that it's like, you know, in a moment, it's everywhere, you know. In a moment, a feeling comes into the body. I have my body gets flooded with certain chemicals every now and then. You know, hormones come, and they make my body feel pretty bad. And I feel the kind of contracting around it. You know, it's like I can see it begin. Even, you know, I can begin to see I have enough sensitivity sometimes to even feel when those hormones are released into the system. It's like, okay, here it comes. But I can still see the mind clamp down, you know. This is not okay. The mind feels resistance to this. Perfectly normal and natural for the mind to feel resistance to that. And yet it's not necessary. It's very conditioned. I mean, when we feel something unpleasant, to contract. You know, this is in the simplest level of what goes on for us around wanting. There's something unpleasant in our experience, we tighten. We don't like it. We want to get rid of it. And that's not to say that we shouldn't take action to do something about something that's unpleasant. But what we're doing, where the suffering is in this moment, is resisting what is already here. This unpleasantness of these hormones flooded through my body is already here. It's actually futile. It's useless to resist that. It's useless to contract around that. It actually makes it worse to contract around that. That's what we start to see, that our contracting, our wishing it were some other way, brings more suffering into the picture. So in this moment, wishing it were some other way, that's a lot of where our struggles happen, is that there's something happening right now, and it's like we just want to deny that it's happening right now. We want to change that it's happening right now. Now, that's not to say that we can't take action to step into the next few moments to change things. With respect to these hormones, there's not much I can do except ride it out. It's just not. So it's just a matter of allowing it to flow through. And I notice that when I can let go of that contraction, it's a much easier ride through the experience. It's not so difficult. So other situations, you know, you might be in a situation where, you need to take some action to get yourself out of a dangerous situation. You know, it's not to just sit back and say, oh, wanting, I shouldn't be wanting. I'm not supposed to want to get myself out of this dangerous situation. That's not what this teaching is saying. But it is saying to not fight with what's happening right now, to not fight with the fear, to not fight with the pain, the distress in the body, and to take action to do what you need to do to take care of yourself in the next moments. So it's really a lot about looking, what am I resisting right now? What's already here that I am resisting or fighting or wanting to be different, or holding on to, wanting it to stay, because we do that too. We find ourselves in a situation that's really pleasant. You know, some of these meditative experiences can be really pleasant. It's like, oh yeah, I want this to stay. Let's hold on to this one. And that's a tightening. That's a grasping. And that actually prevents us from really fully appreciating the joy, the beauty of that moment, because we're trying to hold on to it. So on both sides, you know, whether we're trying to get rid of something that's unpleasant in the moment, that's already happening, again, that's kind of, it's useless to wish that it were some other way, because it's already like this. Now, I think this is where we get confused, is the difference between what does it mean to be accepting of what is here right now? And what does it mean to navigate our life, to step forward into the next moment in the most skillful way? And one of the things I'd like to suggest is that if we can actually be non-resistant to what's happening right now and not holding on to what's happening right now if it happens to be pleasant, that stance will give us the most skillful way to navigate the next moment, that we will have the most, we'll meet the next moment with the most skillful approach, which will help us to not suffer in the future. So I hope that spoke some to what you asked. Other questions? I mean, we've got a few minutes. I've got more to say, but again, we can carry on next week too. Okay, I'll just keep going. Let's see. So, the Buddha suggested for this noble truth, the wanting, the craving, that we should let go of the wanting. Now, this is some of what I was addressing just now, but what I'd like to explore this a little bit. What does it mean to let go of the wanting? And this is, I think, an area that we misinterpret, we misunderstand at times. We think because we're heading in the direction of letting go of wanting, that we're not supposed to want, and that we're supposed to get rid of the wanting. That's just yet the craving applied to this process all over again. You know, I want to get rid of the wanting. So we do this. We replay these patterns in our lives. So the practice is not to want to get rid of the wanting, but to explore, to open to, what does it mean? What does it feel like to want? Just as in my description of watching the wanting while people were walking around by me, that feeling, what does it feel like? I learned so much by watching the wanting. So this, for me, this is an exploration not of saying, oh, there's wanting, I should let it go. That the term that's used is to abandon the wanting. I should abandon it. Well, how do I abandon it? It's already here. It's functioning. I don't know how to abandon it. In fact, there have been times in my meditation where I could really feel that I was holding on to something, and it'd be like, well, I'd let go if I knew how. I have no idea how to let go of this. So at that at those times, what we do is we watch the wanting. So we let it be. We explore the wanting by turning towards it. Rather than acting on it, the acting on it is our habit. That's the way that we've perpetuated this cycle of wanting, by saying, oh, there's wanting, let me get what I want. But instead, rather, to turn towards the feeling of wanting. What does it feel like to be a human being that wants? What does that feel like? To be willing to sit in that space of wanting. It doesn't feel very good. It takes some courage to sit in that space of wanting, because you're right in the midst of the feeling of dissatisfaction when you're feeling wanting. And so much of our being is driven to get rid of that feeling of dissatisfaction. It's like, it's not okay to sit in a space of dissatisfaction. We have learned to avoid that feeling. And so it takes some courage to turn towards it, to be willing to meet that feeling. Really helpful to meet it in the body. When it's strong in particular, it does have a feeling in the body. And there's all kinds of feelings that may be associated with it as well. Feelings of abandonment, of loss, of frustration that can come with this feeling of wanting. So can you be willing to have the courage to be with that experience of wanting? This willingness will allow, rather than acting on it, will allow that wanting to have its own cycle, to live its life, and to disappear in its own good time. It will disappear if you don't act on it. It will disappear. It may come up again, but you'll be able to watch it actually come and go. And you'll start to see, oh, this wanting is also an impermanent phenomenon. And when we begin to see that we don't have to be driven by our wanting, when it doesn't have to be the slave driver for us, we begin to see, oh, I can ride this out. When we get that confidence to ride out wanting, there's an awful lot of freedom that comes. We find ourselves able to navigate our lives in a much more skillful and healthy way. So much of that wanting comes out of our subconscious, you know. Those wantings pop up, and we often are acting on them before we even know they're there. But when we see that wanting, when we can actually see it, if you can be willing to hang with it, that will really serve you. So this letting be, letting go of acting on the wanting, see if you can just explore it. Have the courage to explore it. So doing this points to the three insights. I talked about the insights associated with the first noble truth. There is suffering. Suffering should be understood. Suffering has been understood. The three insights associated with the second noble truth. as there is a cause of suffering. This is craving. So that's that recognizing, oh, this is wanting. To recognize that wanting is actually coming up, that's an insight, because we don't normally see it. We just act on it. So if we can actually see, oh, this is wanting, that's the first insight that the Buddha pointed to with this noble truth. To recognize wanting is happening. And then the second insight is this wanting, this craving should be abandoned. To recognize the value of the letting go. That's another insight. As we begin to explore this wanting and see how it benefits us to, instead of acting on the wanting, to simply allow it to let go, and we see the freedom, the release that comes with that, we understand the value of that letting go. And that letting go often is actually the letting be, the exploration of what does it feel like to want. Because much of the time, we cannot just choose to let go of wanting. In my experience, I've not been able to do that. I can occasionally incline the mind, remind myself, oh, that's not so useful, and that can help me to not act on it. But mostly I can't just say, wanting be gone. The mind is not so amenable as that. But I can see, oh, here's wanting. And it should be, can I see if I can let this be so it will let go? That's that second insight. Craving should be released. Craving should be abandoned. And then the third insight, craving has been abandoned. That is that moment that I described of seeing when somebody disappeared, poof, the wanting is gone. That was the recognition of that third insight around this second noble truth. This has been released. The feeling of the wanting being released is freedom. And this is actually, this leads us right into the third noble truth, because the release of the craving is the definition of the freedom from suffering. So each of these three insights takes us. I look at the three insights that are associated with each noble truth as being like the whole path through. In one noble truth, if we just paid attention to suffering, recognizing this is suffering, understanding it, and then seeing that it has been understood, that's enough to free us. If we do the same with wanting, wanting is present. Wanting should be released. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Seeing it release, that is the freedom. So, we need to stop. I went over 3 minutes, sorry about that. Lost track of time. So, I have more to say about this topic, so I'll continue next week. It's a huge topic. So. Thank you.